KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Who was the best U.S. president? What about the worst? Historian Robert Mary plays Rate the Presidents based on popularity and historical judgment. Here are some hints. Abraham Lincoln is consistently at the top, while James Buchanan ranks as one of the country's biggest failures. Mary spoke at Town Hall on September 10, 2012.
It's a delight to be here, I must say, because I didn't know much about the Seattle Town Hall, the Town Hall Seattle, until I was looking around for places to peddle my book, and then I heard about it, and I heard about it and found that it's a very intriguing institution here in Seattle, and I commend all the people here and also all of you for coming, and I thank you for coming. I want to talk about my book, Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians, and I will tell you that the idea for the book began with a phone call that I received in early 2010 from a New York Times op-ed editor by the name of Mark Lotto. Mark Lotto wanted to know if I was interested in writing a piece for the Times on a recent remark by President Obama to Diane Sawyer of ABC News, who apparently was chiding the president a bit on the apparent unpopularity of some of his programs and policies. He responded perhaps a bit defensively, maybe with a little bit of defiance, and he said, "I would rather be a really good one-term president than a mediocre two-term president." And Lotto wanted to know, given the fact that my most recent book had been a history of the James K. Polk administration, and James Polk is generally considered by historians to be the greatest of our one-term presidents, he wanted to know if I wanted to write about some of the other one-term presidents to determine whether there are, in fact, great one-term presidents as opposed to mediocre two-term presidents. I said I was very interested in writing a piece, but I'd like to take just a little bit of a different tack, and I would like to essentially compare history's judgment of presidents with the contemporaneous judgment of the electorate, because I thought that that kind of gets to the heart of what Obama said, which I consider to be a rather remarkable statement for a sitting president. What he said essentially was that he was willing to accept unpopularity, even to the point of voter rejection, in favor of the esteem of history. And I wanted to pursue the question, how realistic is this? So I wanted to look at history's judgment. What is history's judgment? Well, history's judgment essentially is manifest in the polls that the academics conduct every so often. It started in 1948 when Arthur Schlesinger, Sr. of Harvard University, polled 55 academics, mostly historians, a smattering of political scientists, a few journalists, and asking them to rate and rank the presidents. And since then, there have been a whole body of polls over the course of the years, and a body of literature has grown up around those polls. And so that's history's judgment. And I want to compare that with the contemporaneous judgment of the electorate as reflected in such questions as, well, was the president reelected? If he was reelected, did the voters retain his party in power following his second term, meaning that his second term was sufficiently successful that the voters wanted his party to retain power? What was happening in terms of midterm elections? Maybe a little look at the polls that were manifest during that time. And what we see, and what I anticipated we would see, is a very large correlation between the assessment of history and the assessment of the voters. Generally, seldom does history hail a president that was rejected by the voters, and seldom does history debunk a president who was hailed by the voters. So the question posed by Obama, and I'll put it just a little bit differently this time as it relates to he himself, can he set himself above the electorate with unpopular programs or unsuccessful programs to such an extent that he gets tossed out by the electorate and still get high praise from historians? And history suggests that this is almost impossible, very, very unlikely. So he essentially set up a false dichotomy between political popularity and governmental success. Now, I have to say that I can't help noticing that President Obama is not campaigning these days as a president who would be content to be a one-term president of any kind. But leaving that aside, I will have to say also that as I did this piece for the Times and I did some research and all this and collected some of this data, it occurred to me also that there are exceptions to this rule of the correlation. And I became quite intrigued, and it was at that point that I thought of expanding this topic into a book designed as an exercise in presidential analysis, looking at how presidents fail, how presidents succeed, how we assess their performance, under the rubric of my working title, which was The Great White House Rating Game. And we, you know, we rate the greatest first baseman of all times. I was speaking at a famous bookstore in Washington, D.C., Politics and Prose, some time back on this, and one of the questioners said, well, how is this different from such questions as who's the greatest first baseman of all time? And somebody in the back of the room yelled, Lou Gehrig, of course. Well, you know, we have these games with singers, we have them with movie stars, we have them with sports teams, we have them with athletes, and we have them with the President of the United States. The difference is that the President of the United States holds in his hands our destiny, our national destiny, and that's, in my view, why this is a much more significant rating game. And I'm also very mindful of what Mark Twain said. In fact, I begin the book with Mark Twain's quote, one of my favorites. It's difference of opinion that makes horse races. What occurred to me was that there's a significant difference between the horse race as it relates to Mark Twain's difference of opinion and the Great White House Rating Game. Because with horse races, the difference of opinion ends at the finish line. With the White House Rating Game, the difference of opinion is ongoing and endless. It just goes on forever. So that's why it's a game. And I ask in the book, want to play? So let's play a little bit. I'll begin by looking at the two modes of assessment that I mentioned, the judgment of history. And I look in the book at seven specific academic polls in which there were respondents numbering nearly 1,200. To me, that represents a body of assessment. It's not anyone's individual judgment. It's not my individual judgment. It is a collective judgment of people who have some expertise in the area. And then, as I note, the judgment of the electorate. And I'll begin a little bit with the disparities. First of all, presidents that the voters liked and history negative on. Grant, Harding, Coolidge. And in a little bit different category, Eisenhower and Reagan. And then presidents that history likes, but the voters were somewhat negative on. Wilson in his second term, Cleveland, John Adams, and Truman. Truman makes a very interesting case, which I'll mention in a moment. He's one of my favorite presidents, but he's also one of my favorite examples of what I want to illustrate here. So let's begin with history's judgment. And consistently, the historical polls rate nine greats or near greats. There's a strong consensus in these polls, and they are Lincoln, Washington, and FDR, almost always, not always, but almost always in that order, followed by, in various rank order, Jefferson, Jackson, Polk, Theodore Roosevelt, Wilson, and Truman. Now, all these presidents were two-termers except for Polk. But Polk is kind of the exception who actually does prove the rule because he chose not to run for a second term. He's the only president who actually ran. He made this promise when he got the nomination, if elected, I will not run again for a second term, and he kept that promise. He's the only president who ran on such a one-term promise. So all eight who sought re-election got re-elected, and all but two of those were succeeded by their own party, which is, in my view, the highest electoral assessment that a president can get from the voters. The exceptions being Wilson and Truman, both of whom we will discuss momentarily. So history and the electorate are very much in sync here. Now let's look at those judged by histories to be presidential failures. We have, in that category, generally speaking, Buchanan, Pierce, Andrew Johnson, Fillmore, Harding, in later polls since his abjectly embarrassing resignation, Richard Nixon. And there's not a two-term president of the bunch, except for Richard Nixon, who didn't serve out his second term. But there is a two-term outlier who I find sort of interesting, and that is Ulysses S. Grant. Now, here's where the story gets a little bit complicated, as life often does. History has judged Grant until very, very recently, consistently in these polls, as a failure. Now, he was a two-term president succeeded by his own party, so he really is an outlier here in what I'm trying to create as a matrix of analysis. But the Republicans retained the presidency in 1876 only through the corrupt manipulations of the vote. And the story is somewhat well known. It's not a pretty story in American history about how Samuel Tilden, the Democrat, beat Rutherford B. Hayes in both the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. But the South was under occupation at that time. Reconstruction was in full force. And it turns out, all of a sudden, that there were some vote changes, recapitulation of the vote, as George Wallace said happened to him one time. He said, never allow your vote to be recapitulated by the officials. Well, there was a recapitulation of the vote, and lo and behold, there were two states turned the other way, and that gave Rutherford B. Hayes and the Electoral College victory by one vote. Well, this call came to Washington, and there had to be an adjudication of this, and Congress didn't know how to handle it, too hot to handle, really. They gave it to a commission that was supposed to be bipartisan, but it really wasn't bipartisan, and the commission kind of said, well, we think that this recapitulated vote is the correct vote, and so Rutherford B. Hayes is going to be the president. But there was actually a backdoor deal, a backroom deal in all of this, and it was, we'll tell you what we'll do. We'll give Rutherford B. Hayes the presidency, but in exchange to the Democrats of the South, we will end Reconstruction. And that's essentially what happened. So you can say that Grant is a two-term president succeeded by his own party, but you've got to have an asterisk there to sort of explain all this. Nevertheless, let's look at his presidency. Grant's first term was a clear success. He presided over a frothy economic boom, which attended massive railroad construction during that time. That was a time of post-Civil War industrialization. And the voters had no particular reason to toss him out, and they didn't. They gave him a second term. Second term, much, much less successful. He presided over a nasty financial scandal, a series of scandals actually involving White House and cabinet officials. He didn't handle the scandal very well once it broke. He was very slow. In fact, he never really did separate himself from the nefarious actions of these advisors of his and his friends. He presided over an economic downturn that was quite severe, and he didn't really do very much to ameliorate that. He didn't try to attack it in any significant way. So his second term was much less successful, and the Republicans should have lost. And depending on how you want to look at that story of the vote count, they did lose. So taken together, I would say that the voters were probably closer to the mark than the historians. He's not an abject failure, but he's not a particularly successful president, and he could be residing maybe somewhere in the middle range, which raises a point that historians and voters view presidents totally differently, not just in terms of the outcome of their thinking, but also just in terms of their analytical framework. The historians look at a president's overall term, however long he served in office, and what he accomplished during that period of time. Was it great or near great or failure or mediocre or whatever? And they put a tag on it. The voters look at presidents as they were invited to look at the presidents by the Constitution, by the framers. They look at the presidents in four-year increments. In fact, the four-year term, I believe, is one of the great hallmarks of American democratic civic stability. But nevertheless, they were invited to look at these presidents. They have hiring and firing authority over these guys, and they take it very, very seriously. So they look at it in four-year terms. So let's look at my favorite example of this dichotomy, Harry S. Truman. You got to love that guy, a plucky Midwesterner. The last president who never went to college. He was a, however, a voracious reader of history, and he had a good understanding of history. And history sort of requited that by listing him among the near greats almost immediately, as soon as he gave up the presidency in 1953. However, the voters in his last year grew very tired of this guy. In fact, in 1948, his last full year in office, he had a Gallup approval rating of 22%. It almost doesn't get any worse than that. So how do we square this? Well, let's look at the historical record. His overall record was could only be considered highly successful. He made the agonizing decision to drop the atomic bomb, and should be agonizing to all of us in retrospect, but nevertheless, it saved probably a million American lives in terms of not having to invade Japan. He presided over America's role in creating the United Nations and the Bretton Woods global monetary regimen. He fostered containment policy that saved Western Europe from Russian Bolshevism poised in the heart of on the edge of Western Europe with 1.3 million troops of Soviet and East Bloc troops. He fostered the Marshall Plan. He presided over the National Security Act of 1947, which created the Defense Department and consolidated the defense and intelligence agencies. He presided over a successful transition of the country from a wartime economy to a peacetime economy. He made the really bold and courageous decision of the Berlin airlift. All this occurred in his first term. So it's not surprising that the voters would give him a second term. A lot of people didn't think he was going to get a second term, but he was inevitably going to get a second term because his first term was so successful. His second term, however, was mediocre at best. He had a couple of notable achievements, the creation of NATO, the MacArthur's Incheon landing in the Korean War, but he presided over a sputtering economy almost throughout his entire full term, his second term. He presided over a stalemated war in Korea. He was in a war that he couldn't win and couldn't get out of. That is political poison for any sitting president. He was beset by a series of scandals involving presidential cronies, old pals of his from the old Pendergast machine in St. Louis that he had installed in positions for which they were not qualified. So the voters in the Democratic Party signaled to him very strongly that there was no point in his trying to get the nomination in 1952, and he didn't try. And then the voters nationally summarily tossed out the Democrats from the White House for the first time since 1932. So in my view, history and the voters both had it right, even though they're looking at the decision of how to assess the presidents in two different frameworks.
Robert Mary, a historian and the author of Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. Mary spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 10th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
824 94.9 KUOW. A former investigator for Nortel blames Ottawa officials for failing to act when he warned them Chinese spies were plundering the secrets of the high-tech giant. Hundreds of girls are marching on the Kenyan High Court to demand protection from police they say are failing them. A Calgary psychiatrist on trial for alleged sexual abuse of patients is also accused of using shock therapy to, quote, cure, unquote, gays during the apartheid era in South Africa. And two decades after River Phoenix's death, the director of his final film gives the movie its premiere. Details on all these points tonight at 11. If you have not pledged yet, we're very close to the end of the pledge drive, but of course your pledge is required if you haven't provided it yet, because listener support is the biggest single source of funding for this service. If you listen, please pledge, and you can do that right now online at kuow.org. Thank you. Support for KUOW comes from Live Nation, presenting soprano Sarah Brightman, bringing an operatic style to pop, classical, and rock in concert at the Comcast Arena in Everett, Friday, March 22nd. Tickets go on sale Monday, October 15th at 10 a.m. at livenation.com.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Abraham Lincoln and Franklin D. Roosevelt are consistently ranked as some of the country's best presidents. Historian Robert Mary rates the presidents based on both popularity and historical judgment. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 10, 2012. Next, Mary talks about the differences between how history and voters view two American presidents.
Now let's take a look at a couple of examples where history may have been too generous. Now, I'm only saying this because there's a dichotomy between what history says and what the voters were saying. It's not my judgment, but I'm trying to bring some analytical formulation to the question. And these two presidents are John Adams and Grover Cleveland. Now, in the first academic poll that I mentioned, 1948, Arthur Schlesinger Sr., Cleveland was ranked number 8 among all the presidents, and John Adams right behind him at number 9. Now, Cleveland, let's talk about him for a minute. We don't know much about Cleveland. I have to say, I didn't know much about Cleveland until I started doing some research for this book. But everyone knows that he's the only president who served two non-consecutive terms. Less well known is the fact that his party lost the White House after each term. Therefore, we could say that Stephen Grover Cleveland is the only two-time, one-term president in our history. He's the only guy who served in office for a term and then had the voters reject his party, the first time with him on the ballot, the second time without him on the ballot because the Democratic Party basically didn't want him on the ballot, so they put William Jennings Bryan on the ballot, but he was essentially rejected. Now, his first defeat in 1888, he was elected first in 1884, Cleveland, as I say, was on the ballot, and it was a near thing. He actually won the popular vote, but he lost in the Electoral College. And I would characterize his first term as decent, though not exemplary. He created, Congress created the Interstate Commerce Act, which went after the railroad trusts, although Cleveland didn't really associate himself with that legislation, so it's not quite accurate to give him full credit for it. But he was president. And in our system, president gets full credit and full blame for what happens during his tenure. He presided over solid economic growth. He curbed very significant abuses that had emerged in the Civil War pension and disability program. And he did that using the veto pen. But he presided over substantial labor unrest with significant loss of life. Domestic tranquility is very important for a sitting president if he can't provide it, if it gets interrupted by a loss of life in civic unrest. That is a black mark against a sitting president. And there was a significant amount of property damage as well. And he failed to reduce tariff rates, which is what he had campaigned on and what Democrats did in those days. So his second term is, in my view, a clear failure. Then, after he Benjamin Harrison was elected in 1888, served 4 years, not an exemplary president. So Cleveland comes back in. Second term, as I say, was a clear failure. Persistent economic downturn, sputtering throughout that time, extensive bank failures, corporate bankruptcies, devastation in the farm sector. So pretty middling at best, and I think the voters had it right. So here's the question. Why would the academics in 1948 put Grover Cleveland at like number 8? Well, for one thing, the academics don't necessarily buy the idea that the voters are always right. Like, it's not like retailing where the customer is always right, but I tend to think that maybe it is a bit like retailing. Secondly, I have a chapter called The Vagaries of History, and the vagaries of history is how reputations can rise or fall based on changing modes of thought or different outlooks or viewpoints or something we learn historically about a particular president. In this case, Alan Nevins, the great American historian from that era, had written a biography of Cleveland called Grover Cleveland, A Study in Courage. It was a really kind of a very highly positive look at Grover Cleveland, and I think that that probably influenced a lot of academics, including some, I suspect, who may not have even read Alan Nevin's two-volume biography of Alan Nevin's. I have to say that of Grover Cleveland, my next project is concentrated on the 1890s and the Spanish-American War, and it's kind of a sequel to my previous book before this one on the 1840s. And I'm going to have to read this two-volume Alan Nevin's biography of Grover Cleveland, and I know that Alan Nevin's a beautiful writer, so I should be looking forward to it. But I'm not absolutely sure that I am, but we'll see. Let's talk about John Adams. Now, John Adams was a great man. There's no question about that. He was a great patriot, and he was a great contributor to our nation's birth. And we all know this, not least because of David McCullough's magisterial book and the wonderful HBO series. But he was not a great president, and I don't think he was even a near great president. He presided over significant French abuse of U.S. commercial shipping and seemed to be hapless in the face of that. And we don't elect our presidents to be hapless in the face of some kind of a foreign threat. He signed, and I think he kind of fostered behind the scenes, the Alien and Sedition Acts, one of the most nefarious pieces of legislation ever enacted in our history, that criminalized public criticism of the government and he used the Sedition Act to essentially root out French immigrants who were considered potentially hostile to the Federalist sensibilities which were fueling Adams' presidency. There's a story that I particularly cherish of one quiet bookstore owner in Philadelphia. He was a Frenchman, he was a French immigré, and he was quietly leading a simple life running a bookstore in Philadelphia. And the word came back, he had been singled out for deportation under the Sedition Act. And he didn't really know why. He wasn't even involved in politics to speak of, and so he had a friend who had some connections in the government, and he said, "Can you find out why I'm being singled out? They're going to ship me back to France. I don't really want to go." So his friend reported back that the president was asked about this, and he said, nothing in particular, but he's too French. Questionable at the very least, right? Now, he also presided over massive tax increases, largely because he was trying to gird America for this looming battle with the French, which never really materialized. As a result of that taxation, the economy began to sputter. So the voters in 1800 basically sent him packing. And I have to say, I think the voters had it about right, and the historians perhaps are a bit off the mark. So I will say that both Cleveland and Adams have seen their rankings slip somewhat since that 1948 poll where they were 8th and 9th, but they're still ranked rather high. These kinds of questions are what fascinate me and why I sat down to write this book. So we're on a roll here, aren't we? So let's see if we can continue with a few more of these guys and look at where history and the electorate actually converge. But on the other side, let's take a look at Warren G. Harding. Now, Warren G. Harding is considered a total failure. He was in the rankings, in the polls, he's almost always, until very recently, dead last. The worst president in our history. And you recall that he was elected in 1920 after Woodrow Wilson. He died in office about 3 years into his term. And he was a passive chief executive. There's no question about that. He's viewed generally as a vacuous suit of clothes whose career was fueled largely by the fact that he seemed to just look precisely like what people thought a president should look like. But people shake their heads at the guy, at his 15-year affair he had with a married woman by the name of Carrie Phillips, who just happened to be the wife of his closest friend. They snicker at the sort of vision of the sexual tryst he had in a coat closet in the White House with a starry-eyed young woman named Nan Britton, who was 31 years his junior. And he's dismissed generally as a weak, inert chief executive who let Congress set the agenda. And finally, he's scored as a result of the Teapot Dome scandal, which broke after he died in office. Still, as Arthur Schlesinger Jr., once said. He was more careless than villainous. He was overly protective of aides that he should have been looking at and looking over more closely. And it's true, it's fair to say that he also appointed some really top-level people of historical dimension in key positions in his administration. Alice Roosevelt Longworth, as she so often did, had it about right, in my view, when she said, "Oh, Warren Harding was not a bad man. He was just a slob." But let's face it, he was never implicated in any scandal himself. In fact, he was a newspaper owner. He ran a small newspaper in Ohio. There's no evidence that he ever used his governmental position to enhance his business interests, unlike, say, for example, we could say Lyndon Johnson, who got his rich friends to get him into the very, very lucrative television business in Austin so he could get rich while he was serving the American people. Nothing bad happened to the country during his tenure. There were no riots in the streets. He didn't get us into any intractable wars. He got the country through Wilson's very severe economic depression very, very quickly with policies that are worth study today, in my view, and then presided over a very robust economy, including GDP growth rate in 1922 of 14%. I think that may be the highest growth rate of any year in our history, and I would say that our current president, Barack Obama, could use three or four of those percentage points if they were available. And as I say, there was a significant amount of social unrest in the Woodrow Wilson's last term, and it seemed to evaporate in Harding's term. So you could say that he was elected essentially to nullify Wilsonism, and we'll talk about Wilson in a minute, and he fulfilled that mandate. And one could argue that's not such a bad record, maybe certainly one that deserves to be ranked a little bit better than dead last among all U.S. presidents. So now let's get to Wilson. Now here's where I have a view that is sometimes considered quite controversial because he's my least favorite president. And I'm not saying he should be ranked dead last. I think that honor should always be bestowed upon James Buchanan. But nevertheless, I think that we should put into perspective just what Woodrow Wilson accomplished and what he didn't accomplish and what transpired during his presidency. His first term was a clear success. I would say maybe of modest proportions, but nevertheless, a clear success. He brought down tariff rates. That's what Democrats did in those days. He initiated banking reform, very big banking reform. He created the Federal Reserve System. He presided over the enactment of the Clayton Antitrust Act, which went against the monopolies in the United States, something that needed to be done. He overcame some economic difficulties that emerged in his term, and he overcame them before he had to face the voters, which is always a smart thing for any sitting president. And finally, and most significantly, his reelection slogan, "He kept us out of war." Then he was reelected, and he promptly maneuvered the country into war by manipulating neutrality issue in ways that favored Great Britain and in a way that predictably was going to lead to some kind of action on the part of the desperate Germans. Now, his Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, warned him about this. He said, "If you're going to continue with these policies, you're going to get this country into the war." Well, that's what Wilson wanted. And as soon as William Jennings Bryan realized that, he quit. He resigned in protest. So he got us into the war. And then he presided over the administration of the war, both in terms of the military action and also in terms of domestic policy, in ways that transformed American society almost overnight and in ways that were considered by the American people to be very unhealthy and unfortunate. He nationalized the telegraph, telephone, and railroad industries. He instituted a military draft. That was a necessity and something like that. Taxes surged dramatically, and the result of that was that the economy flipped out of control. GDP was down the first full year after we got into the war by 5%, the following year by another 6%. That's a very serious downturn. Nothing like we haven't experienced anything like that in our own time right now under the Great Recession. There was a significant suppression of dissent under this Attorney General Palmer, who's become infamous in history. There were urban riots, as I say, that's political poison for a sitting president. And the war never yielded what he promised it would yield. And by 1920, it was clear that the American people were basically saying to themselves, we got to get this guy out of here and his party with them. Now, I'll mention one other thing about Woodrow Wilson, something that I don't like in politicians, and that is he was a sanctimonious guy. Now, the sanctimonious presidents, in my view, have been John Quincy Adams, James K. Polk, my guy, who was a successful president, but his presidency was marked by far more difficulty than necessary because of his sanctimony, Jimmy Carter, in my view, and George W. Bush. And none of them ended up being truly significant or successful presidents, in part because of that particular trait. So here we have Wilson. Historians have consistently put him in the great or near great category, but the voters ended up being very, very negative. And I have to say, I believe that history is close, that the voters are close to the mark. I will say that 1920 election, in which Harding was elected, and he was not a distinguished man at all by anyone's measure, was truly one of the greatest repudiations of a sitting presidential party that we've had in our country's history. So it's got to tell you something.
Robert Mary, a historian and the author of Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. Mary spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 10th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Robert Mary in a moment. 842, 94.9 KUOW. Political stakes are high in a number of House and Senate contests around the country. A look at important contests to watch and at how the outcomes could shape the new Congress. That's tonight at midnight. Listener financial contributions are the fuel in this broadcast engine, in this news and information programming engine. If you have not pledged during our fall pledge drive, please do. You can do so right now online at kuow.org. It's quick and easy, and it's important. Thank you. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight, lows upper 40s. Partly cloudy this evening, becoming mostly cloudy. Friday highs mid to upper 50s, rain at times. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows around 50 and showers. Saturday highs a little higher, around 60, and rain at times again. More special election season coverage coming up next hour. The second Washington gubernatorial candidates debate. That'll be at 9 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from the Midwives of Washington State and the Washington State affiliate of the American College of Nurse Midwives, celebrating National Midwifery Week with the annual Miles for Midwives Fun Run at Lincoln Park on October 21st. Information and registration at milesformidwives.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Robert Mary is a historian and the author of Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. He researched both history and popular opinion to rank our country's executives. Mary spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 10, 2012. Next, he talks about the presidents who are revered both by historians and the people.
So let's get now to when the voters and the historians actually converge. And they converge on what I call the greatest of the great, or in the book, I have a chapter on the leaders of destiny. And there are three criteria for inclusion into this hallowed circle of history. One is that they consistently get high rankings in historians' polls. In other words, since I believe that the historians' polls have some value, though maybe not definitively, they should be taken into account here, and therefore, if they're consistently in the great or near great category, then they're eligible for be a leader of destiny. Number two, they were two-term presidents succeeded by their own party, meaning that the American people also viewed them as successful presidents that they whose tenures they respected and appreciated. And then finally, I had my own definition, criterion, and that is that they transform the country's political landscape and set it upon a new course. Now, this is very difficult to do. Not many presidents have done that. And for one thing, not many presidents are two-term presidents followed by their own party in our history. There are only eight presidents who have been elected twice and who then saw their party retain power after their second term. If you count partial terms, such as Teddy Roosevelt or Abraham Lincoln, obviously, then you've got 12 of these two-term presidents succeeded by their own party. So who are they? Are you ready for this? Suspense is killing me. But they are Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, T.R., and F.D.R. in that order of service. So let's talk about them briefly. Washington, he set it all in motion, and he did it brilliantly. He did it brilliantly with deft and very judicious decision-making. And then he did a remarkable thing, which the country has never stopped appreciating, and that is he relinquished power at an appropriate time. In world history, that is very rare. Now Jefferson. Jefferson obliterated the Federalist effort to craft an American aristocracy, made sure that that would never happen. And he established the small government ethos as a significant political sensibility. Jackson fostered the mass electorate. Things were happening in American politics, especially in the West, in places like Tennessee and Kentucky, and in the Midwest after the Louisiana Purchase, which, by the way, goes with Jefferson also as a remarkable accomplishment. And what was happening out there was that presidential politics was becoming democratized in new ways. The property requirement for voting was coming to an end. Popular election of electors that were going to select the president was emerging in those places. And Jackson understood the significance of this. He was not a tutored man. He was not an educated man particularly, although he read rather widely. He was a rough-hewn guy, but he had amazing instincts for understanding things that were going on around him and around the country. And he understood the significance of this, and therefore he democratized American politics by essentially institutionalizing this increased democratization that was going on in the West. Therefore galvanized it with what I call conservative populism, which it was the dominant political outlook in America for 25 years. Lincoln, we all know, he saved the Union and freed the slaves, but he also turned the fledgling Republican Party into an agency of industrialization, which somebody had to do it. There was going to have to be an industrialization because this new technology was so powerful and it was going to transform people's lives, and the Republican Party became that party. But then, over time, over the decades, it began to be clear that there were some weaknesses and difficulties and problems that this industrialization was fostering along with this great economic growth. And it was Teddy Roosevelt who basically brought forth the political idiom focused on curbing the abuses of the industrial age. So he gets into that category. And finally, FDR, who saved democratic capitalism from the ravages unloosed upon it by the agonies of the Great Depression. He transformed this man, whatever you think about him, and I'm mixed in my views about Franklin Roosevelt in terms of what he unleashed in America, but the stuff of greatness he had in abundance. He transformed America by dealing with the Depression and probably in necessary ways, maybe not exactly how it needed to be done, but in necessary ways. And he then, in taking America into World War II, he transformed the world. Very few men in history can rise to that level of accomplishment. So what were the common attributes of these men of destiny? Well, the first thing that has to happen when a person is elected president and wants to be a man of destiny, and I think that our current president, Barack Obama, is one of those people who had such a dream and an ambition, is the country has to be desirous of that kind of change. It has to be ready for a new direction. And the country isn't always in that position. And if a president is elected in a time when a country isn't hungry for that kind of a new direction, and he tries to move in a new direction, he's usually almost inevitably going to get pulled back. And that's what happened, for example, to Bill Clinton after his first 2 years in office, and he very cleverly recalibrated his approach to politics and crafted a very deft left-center way, mode of governing America, and it proved to be highly successful. So you can't change the political landscape when the landscape doesn't need to be changed. And the American people are the ones who determine that. Because the electorate is not whimsical, it's not promiscuous, and when the national direction is changed, the voters generally stay with it for a considerable period of time until the next crisis breeds a new necessity for a new direction, and therefore, eventually, a new leader of destiny. I happen to believe that we're living in one of those times, and a new leader of destiny is going to emerge, because when we are beset with major civic problems, they are solved in our system through presidential leadership, or they aren't solved at all. But sometimes it takes a fair amount of time for such a person to emerge. One such time was the 1850s, and I believe that our politics today is quite reminiscent of the struggles and the deadlocks and the animosities that we saw in our politics during that time of the 1850s. So the first rule of presidential leadership is you have to know your time. And there are two fine examples of this. I mentioned Clinton, but let me go to Eisenhower. Eisenhower never sought to repeal the New Deal. He understood that the American people had fostered the New Deal, and they had given Franklin Roosevelt, you know, four election victories. And he wasn't going to, just a few years later, come in and say, by the way, American people, you really screwed up in electing Franklin Roosevelt, and I'm going to undo it all. That would have been disastrous, although there were a lot of right-leaning Republicans in the country that wanted him to do that. It would have been disastrous because the American people would say, wait, that's insulting to us. We knew what we were doing then, and we know what we're doing now in giving you the presidency, but if you're going to try to undo that, then you're not going to be a two-term president. Well, he was a two-term president, partly because he understood that. And Clinton, as I mentioned, is another example. He actually said he was going to repeal Reaganism, same sort of thing. And after he had his head handed to him in the 1994 midterm elections, he had a different view. He said the era of big government is over. So that was a tacit acknowledgment that Reaganism remained dominant political force in his time, even though Reagan was long gone, just as was the case with Eisenhower and Roosevelt. So the men of destiny are called up through events and crises, but they had to be ready for it. And there were three attributes that I think are important. And I will say right now that I don't think that vampire hunting is one of them. De Gaulle said, to get to number one, De Gaulle said, a statesman may be determined and tenacious, but if he does not understand the character of his time, he will fail. So part of that is understanding what's really happening in the country and what needs to be done in the country. And often that means creating a new political idiom that captures it. Lincoln is a marvelous example when he said, a house divided against itself cannot stand. Up until that moment when he uttered that, pulling that out of scripture, which he did so often and so effectively, the American people, the politicians in Washington, were struggling desperately to prop up that divided house. And Lincoln comes in and says, excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, a house divided against itself cannot stand. And he was basically saying, we're going to have a whole new brand of politics here. We're going to have to be moving in a new direction to break this deadlock. And it proved to be very, very significant. Secondly, there has to be a vision, a capacity to visualize a new direction for America and a seriously changed country. And finally, there's this vague, complex quality that I call simply political adroitness, which is the ability to sort of harness, to get one's hands on the levers of power and effectively pull them and move them and manipulate them in ways that moves the country towards that vision. So all six of those presidents had it. And here's what I'll offer. Here's where I'll offer a sort of an afterthought about all this. I think that maybe in a moderate way, I think maybe Ronald Reagan had it as well. Now, we're not that far removed from Reagan's presidency, and there's still a lot of political passions that swirl around his tenure. But when you think about it, he certainly was a two-term president succeeded by his own party. Only two in the 20th century who were elected twice and succeeded by their own party, Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan. He certainly changed the political landscape and set the country on a new course. He hasn't been consistently heralded in the historian polls, but he's moving up rather dramatically in recent polls, so he may get to that point, and then he will meet my three criteria. So I just toss that out as part of the difference of opinion that make horse races thing. So in the book, I also talk about what I call the split decision presidents, two-term presidents not succeeded by their own party. What you find is that usually they had a very successful first term, a less successful, sometimes very much less successful, sometimes moderately less successful second term. I talk about the war presidents and the war decision, which is probably politically the most dangerous decision that a president can make. I talk about the failures, and I've talked about them a little bit here. And I talk about the presidents who are too recent for a fair historical assessment. An underlying theme of this book is that this is an amazing institution. Its power emanates from the people, because the people own the office. And this invests the office with considerable political force, because the president is the only man in America, or woman someday, who can claim to speak for all of the people. And yet, there are all kinds of curtailments built in to the system to make sure that this immense power that the president has cannot be abused. So he speaks for all the people, but he must deal with many politicians who speak persistently and legitimately for many, many, many smaller constituencies. And so it's very, very difficult to be successful. So to capture this dichotomy, this duality, I'm going to close with two quotes from two of our presidents, Woodrow Wilson. Just because I don't like him doesn't mean that he didn't say very important things. And he said, and this gets to that whole thing about the people owning the office and the president speaking for all the people. If a president rightly interpret the national thought and boldly insist upon it, he is irresistible. I think that's true, but it's very, very difficult to capture that political moment at any given time. And that's reflected in a quote from our friend Harry Truman, who, when he was president, he used to like to go up, even after he was president, go up and drink bourbon and branch and chat with his buddies up there in the hill. One day he was lamenting the difficulties that were besetting him, and he sort of looked into his bourbon and he growled, "They talk about the power of the presidency, how I can just push a button and get things done. Why, I spend most of my time kissing somebody's ass." So here we are. The president has all that power and possibility that Woodrow Wilson talked about, and he's got all the difficulties that Harry Truman was referring to in that growl. And that is the essence of our presidency. Thank you.
Robert Mary, a historian and the author of Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. Mary spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 10th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Repertory Theater, kicking off its 50th anniversary season with Pullman Porter Blues by Cheryl L. West, featuring a live blues band, playing September.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.